Hi, I'm Doug Henwood. This week's Behind the News was a special fundraising edition of the show. KPFA has been on a spring drive for most of the month. I've been relying on pre-existing premiums for the past 3 weeks. This is the first original material I produced for the fund drive, an interview with Matt Taibbi about his new book, The Divide. It's only a little over half an hour, so this is not a full 52-minute show, but I thought the interview was worth posting anyway, which gets me to the point of this little intro. If you're listening to this on the web or as a podcast, please remember that if it weren't for KPFA, I wouldn't be doing this show. If you like what you hear and want to keep it coming, please contribute to KPFA. You can do so on the web at kpfa.org, where you can choose from any number of thank you gifts, including The Divide, or a USB thumb drive with 54 interviews from the last dozen years that I think are some of the best things I've done behind the news. And aside from my show, KPFA is a wonderful resource that deserves your support. Please give, kpfa.org, and please mention Behind the News with your pledge. On to the abbreviated show. Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks of this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, a special fundraising edition of the show, featuring the prolific and brilliant Matt Taibbi, author of the splendid new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. It comes with some marvelous illustrations by Molly Crabapple, whom I tried to get on the show today, too, but we just couldn't work out the scheduling. Some other time. Amusingly, if you call up The Divide at Amazon, you're informed that customers who bought that item also bought Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. Though very different in style and perspective, both books report in an increasingly polarized society. Piketty's is mostly about money. Taibbi's is mostly about cops, courts, and jails. Specifically, if you're poor, you're likely to find yourself chronically on the wrong side of those things, but if you're rich, you can get away with murder, or close to it. Matt Taibbi first came to prominence with The Exile, a biweekly Moscow-based English paper he co-founded in 1997 with Mark Ames. It was rude, often extremely so, but also brilliant and nervy. Driven out of Russia by an increasingly hostile political environment, Taibbi returned to the U.S., where he started a satirical paper, The Beast, in Buffalo, of all places. From there, he moved on to New York Press, from which he was driven by a piece called The 52 Funniest Things About the Upcoming Death of the Pope. It caused a great political scandal, and he was fired. Fortunately, he found a home at Rolling Stone, where he wrote great stuff about the financial crisis and its aftermath, and coined one of the great phrases of our time, his likening of Goldman Sachs to a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Vampire squids don't suck blood, nor do they have a blood funnel, but so what? It's a tremendous phrase. And now he's moved on to the class divide in our criminal justice system. If you're poor, you're subject to endless harassment by cops and other state functionaries, and you're likely to find yourself in jail. If you're rich, you can steal billions and drive the global economy into a ditch, and you get called a canny businessman by the president. Such is the state of our plutocracy, and here's Matt Taibbi to talk about it. This is, what, your sixth book, Matt?
Yeah, I think so.
You're not working for a website doing pop-ups like everyone?
No. Yeah.
Still doing this long sort of serious reporting and about complicated material for a society with a short attention span.
Exactly. Trying to make that whole thing work. I like to do both things. Obviously, I like to do quick little columns too on the internet, and those are always fun. But you know, over the years, you figure out what works for you and what doesn't. And I think what I probably enjoy the most in terms of just the intellectual challenge is taking really complicated systems and schemes and scams and trying to make them understandable for people. And so I'm still doing that, definitely.
How did you end up getting Molly Crabapple to do the art?
Molly and I met through a mutual friend at Rolling Stone, a woman named Meredith Clark. And what happened was, during the Occupy protests, I found out that Molly had done a series of these posters that were based on themes from some of my articles. Specifically, she did a couple of really cool vampire squid posters that I actually saw when I was in the Occupy protests. I was walking around and I saw people carrying these posters that said, you know, starve the vampire squid and all, you know, stuff like that. And they were, not only was that flattering, but they were really cool looking pictures. So I arranged to meet her, and we kind of have a similar point of view on a lot of things. And also her particular kind of art, she's really great at these sort of gigantic labyrinthine portraits of evil, which is pretty close to what this book is all about. So it seemed like a pretty natural fit, and we decided to hook up for this thing.
Your book is all about how, this is the old saying, go, there are two sets of laws, one for the rich and one for the poor, and it's never been truer. Is that correct?
Yeah, obviously that's not a news story, but I think the point of the book is that there are factors that have accelerated that development and that natural tendency to an extreme degree in the last 20 years or so. We've seen, especially under the Holder Justice Department, kind of an extraordinary like record of non-enforcement. And it was something that I just noticed because every story I wrote for Rolling Stone during the post-crash period had the same ending to it. There were, you know, nobody got indicted, nobody went to jail. So it was impossible to ignore. And then I figured I'd kind of do some due diligence on who does go to jail. And that's how I ended up with this kind of compare and contrast style book.
Poor folks, and who not coincidentally tend to be darker skinned most of the time, can get jailed for the most inconsequential things.
Yeah, like accidentally, like falling backwards, you know. I mean, the walking out of your house and on any given day, you can just sort of accidentally end up in the criminal justice system in ways that a person of means could never imagine happening to them. That was sort of what I was trying to drive home.
Yeah, I mean, if some guy is arrested for obstructing whatever because he's just standing in front of a building, I mean, the stories are insane. Unbelievable.
Yeah, obstruct pedestrian traffic. That was one of my favorite ones. And that turns out to be a real law, part of the disorderly conduct statute in New York. It was designed originally to deal with people who were protesting in places that they weren't supposed to be. If you were standing in a sidewalk and conducting some kind of ad hoc demonstration and you were blocking the flow of traffic, that you could be arrested for that. But what they've expanded that law to be applied to is people just standing around on street corners in places like Bedford-Stuyvesant. It's either that or another very common offense that you see people being pulled in for is refusal to obey a lawful police order to move. So you're standing in one place and a cop tells you to move over there and you don't do it quickly enough. That's another thing you can be pulled in for.
Yeah. Since when does one have to follow the orders of a cop if you're not doing anything particularly illegal?
Right. They actually had a court case about that. I was actually at a hearing for that. I don't think it's been resolved yet. There was a demonstration that sort of brought out this as a legal issue. But all over the country, people, you know, police departments are using that as a reason to arrest people. And whether it's constitutional or legal or not, they are doing it.
Well, there's an interesting conjunction here that some of these laws are part of a broad criminalization of political protest, which are also used as ways to harass people who are not favored by the power elite.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of side development to the whole thing. A lot of these laws that you're seeing being applied to just ordinary people who are going to and from their homes or, you know, on the way to work or on the way back from work. Yes, they were intended as crowd control measures for protests and things like that. It is ironic that it's being used almost like a kind of preemptive tactic to politically undermine people as opposed to, you know, what their intention was, which was to break up people when they already reached the stage of protest.
And you spent a lot of time traveling around the country, and you the welfare offices in San Diego, the criminal courthouses in New York City. I mean, you see this broad pattern of constant harassment and criminalization of behavior by poor people who are just trying to get by. I mean, it's just it's a breathtaking crackdown.
Yeah, and what's I think what I was trying to show is how draconian the basic conclusion of the whole thing is that the criminal justice system for people who don't have money is just this gigantic mindless punishment machine. And it's not so much that it hates the poor or that it's designed to discriminate. It's just there's no room for individual human attention at that level. If you're just somebody who doesn't have a gigantic company and a staff of lawyers to defend you, then you'll get sucked into this thing, and everything is going to be done by the book and by the numbers. And once you get pulled into this mechanism, there's almost never a positive result. Like, for instance, if you get charged with welfare fraud, you're going to lose the case. I mean, once they bring a case against you, it's almost guaranteed that you're going to lose. There are very few people who contest those cases. Lawyers seldom get involved, and when they do, they still are rarely successful. And when you lose those cases, the consequences are incredibly draconian. You know, you will pay 100% restitution, and compare that to what goes on at the big banks. It's where they pay, you know, tiny percentages of what they've stolen. You may lose custody of your kids. You may go to jail. And we're talking about crimes in the hundreds of dollars. I mean, we're not talking about major crimes. And that's what's so significant. It's that it's not so much that people are getting away with these massive frauds at these companies like HSBC and Chase and Goldman Sachs. It's also that people are suffering incredibly severe consequences for much more minor offenses at the other end of the spectrum.
Even just the description of applying for welfare in San Diego, and you just have to stay home and wait for a week and a half for somebody to come, like, inspect your life?
Yeah, no, exactly. They have this program in San Diego they call the P100 program. And in that county, the government asserts the right to preemptively search your home if you've applied for welfare. And the justification is they're trying to make sure that you haven't made any misrepresentations in your welfare application. So if you say, for instance, that you don't have a boyfriend who's helping you with the bills, and almost all these people are single moms, by the way. I mean, 90% of the people I interviewed for this, they were single mothers who had no other option but to apply for welfare. So you go in, you apply for welfare, and then what they do is they tell you, go home and wait. And so they don't tell you when the inspector is going to come. You go home. If you're not there when the inspector comes, you don't get your welfare. So people literally sit in their homes. They have friends come and bring them food because they're afraid to be at the store when the inspector comes. And when he finally does come, he barges into your house and goes through your underwear drawer. And, you know, I heard stories from one woman who was talking about how an inspector reached into her underwear drawer with a pencil end and pulled out a pair of panties from Victoria's Secret and said, who do you need these for? You know, and the implication there is, you know, if you don't have a boyfriend helping you with the bills, why do you need sexy underwear? I mean, it's just like an incredibly violative, obnoxious.
And all this for relatively small sums, like a few hundred bucks a month we're talking.
Oh, yeah, you know, we're talking with people who are, in the best-case scenario, going to get $350 a month in cash assistance. And the amount of resentment that you have to suffer through in order to get that meager sum of money is unbelievable. The entire system looks at these people as if they've already committed an offense. Even after you apply for welfare, you regularly have to go back to the office and fill out a little mini biography attesting to various facts in your life. And at the top of it, you sign under penalty of prosecution, attesting to the fact that all these things were true. And they ask you whether you have a car, whether you have $2,200 in assets, whether you have somebody staying at your house more than two nights a week, how many children you have, all these things. And if they find anything wrong, if a computer generates any kind of discrepancy, then a fraud case is automatically generated. And again, as I said before, once a case begins, it's like a Kafka story. It proceeds straight to the end, and you always lose. I tell these stories, again, to contrast it to the reality in the other end of the spectrum, where companies can commit serious fraud over and over again, and in some cases the same kinds of fraud, and they can be repeatedly let off with warnings and deferred prosecution agreements and minor fines and things of that nature, as opposed to suffering these extreme penalties.
Yeah, I want to get to the rich malefactors in a moment. Just one more tale of repressive horror, though. You described the NYPD, like riding around with a van on hunting expeditions, essentially.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Tell us about this policing policy.
Repeatedly, while I was doing my research, I kept hearing these stories about how police officers had quotas that they would be told to empty a pad of summonses every month or else. I had a lawyer tell me a story about, she just told me to go take a bus to Randall's Island, where they have a mental hospital and some other institutions. What I found was is that police officers, they'll go out and they'll round people up for crimes real and imagined, whether it's dealing drugs or looking like, I talked to two people who were arrested for simply just driving around in too nice of a car. The justification there was possession of marijuana, although they never didn't actually find any drugs. They just said they smelled it. Or it could be like the person you mentioned before, obstructing pedestrian traffic. What they'll do is they'll round these people up, and if once they get enough people, they sort of drop them off in the policing version of a factory ship. There's like a roving van that goes around the neighborhood, and they dump all the arrestees in the van. The formula that I heard was if eight officers go out in a team, they got to bring back eight bodies. So basically what they're doing is they're looking for eight guilty people, and once they fill up the van, they get to go home. And that's, so it's kind of a commercial fishing model of policing. And if you go into poor neighborhoods, you actually, if you look for them, you can see these vans parked all over the place.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who is the author of Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, just out from Spiegel and Grau. Let's talk about the other side, the class divide. And the figure of Eric Holder keeps popping up. He wrote a memo during the Clinton years that became of considerable legal consequence. What was that all about?
So this is affectionately known as the Holder memo. And the interesting part of it is this thing that he put at the very bottom, which was called collateral consequences.
Now, this memo is initially perceived as sort of a crackdown on white-collar crime, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was a sort of get tough on crime memo because it originally gave prosecutors all these tools they could use to go after corporate criminals. The biggest thing being that they could basically force them to waive privilege if they wanted to get credit for cooperation, which made it impossible for companies to hide behind legal privilege if they wanted to avoid very stiff sentences. So that was a powerful tool back then, but in that same memo, he also wrote about a thing called collateral consequences. And in what that meant was, is if you're a prosecutor and you're going after a big company that employs a lot of people, and you are concerned about the quote-unquote innocent victims of a prosecution, like, you know, shareholders or executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing, or maybe even members of the community where the company has its headquarters, you can consider other remedies like non-prosecution agreements or fines or deferred prosecutions. And when he wrote this as a deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration back in the late 90s, the idea didn't really gain a whole lot of traction back then. In fact, it was kind of mothballed for the first 5 years after he wrote it. The Bush administration largely ignored it. And then we had Arthur Andersen, which was a company that got charged with a felony for its role in the Enron scandal, and it went out of business, and a whole lot of jobs were lost, although only temporarily, it should be noted, because most of the company was later acquired by KPMG, and a lot of those jobs were preserved. But politicians were freaked out by the job loss, and so they started pressuring the Justice Department to not criminally charge big companies anymore. And so collateral consequences was kind of dusted off and used as a justification for not criminally charging corporate wrongdoers. And so what we've had since, and when Holder returned to office as Attorney General, not only had Arthur Andersen happened, but now we've had the crash, and we also had this economy that was dominated by these too big to fail companies, where there really would be extreme consequences for prosecution. And that's basically the law of the land right now. Although we had a criminal charge this week of a bank, for the most part, we're not criminally charging either the companies or the individuals of the companies who where serious crimes are committed.
Yeah, it's funny. I think Lloyd Blankfein was expressing existential anxiety the other day over the Credit Suisse plea. I like the idea of Lloyd Blankfein.
Amazing that he's even in touch with his existential side. That's interesting.
But it's worth remembering that the Bush administration actually did some substantial prosecutions in the wake of the bust in 2000-2001.
Yeah, and some of them were actually quite high-handed in a way. I mean, there was Tyco, there was Adelphia, there was WorldCom, there was Enron, there was Arthur Andersen, there was KPMG. You know, the Adelphia case was kind of a nasty bit of business that the Department of Justice not only prosecuted the people who were involved in that accounting scandal, they went into the home of 72-year-old CEO John Regas, and they dragged the guy out of his house at, like, you know, before 7 in the morning, and they perp-walked him for the cameras. And what was interesting about that incident was that when that happened, the New York Stock Exchange, when it was watching that video that day, all the traders, it experienced its second biggest one-day gain in history because of the impression that the government was cleaning up in corporate America, that they were getting rid of, you know, the taking out the garbage in all of these accounting scandals, which is unusual because subsequently people like Eric Holder kept saying that if we arrest these people that it will cause market disruptions and we can't do that, whereas the evidence that I found suggests the opposite, that when we do go in and clean up these companies, that it actually has a positive effect on the markets.
And stepping back to a previous bubble, there was no shyness about prosecuting SNL crooks in the late 80s, early 90s.
No, not at all. In fact, there's an incredible progression, right? We had something on the order of 1,700 prosecutions in the wake of the SNL crisis. About over 800 people actually went to jail. Fast forwarding a decade or so after that, we had all those major prosecutions in the Bush years that we all remember, you know, of the people involved in the Tyco and Adelphia and Enron cases. And then there's 2008, which was a significantly huger mass fraud scandal than either of those two incidents. And yet we had no cases and nobody went to jail in that situation. And that's what's so noteworthy.
You do open the book with a tale of one bank that got prosecuted, Abacus, right? this tiny little thing in Chinatown. What was its crime?
So Abacus was charged essentially with allowing people to falsify their mortgage applications for loans that were ultimately purchased by Fannie and Freddie. And what was interesting about that, out of all the banks that they could have charged with mortgage fraud, you're thinking about all the companies that have been proven through civil cases to have massively defrauded not only public pension plans and foreign hedge funds and trade unions and Fannie and Freddie. Out of all those banks, the one that actually got criminally prosecuted was this little tiny community bank wedged between two noodle shops in Chinatown called Abacus Federal Savings Bank. And even in that case, the state didn't even allege so much as a dollar of losses. What the people were actually doing who were applying for mortgages was they were hiding income that they were generating through cash businesses. So it was the opposite of what typically went on during the mortgage crisis, when banks were giving out loans to people who couldn't afford them, who didn't really have income, and falsifying income records. In this case, it was, you know, Chinese immigrants who were trying to, you know, hide their perhaps not legitimate cash businesses, but they could afford their home loans and they didn't default. And that was the bank that they chose to go after.
You have a long telling of the Lehman collapse, which involved some extremely strange and conspiratorial goings on with Barclays, of course, which resulted in no prosecutions.
Right.
Yeah, well, and, you know, ended up causing massive, massive turmoil in the financial markets and the real economy. What was that dance between Barclays and Lehman all about?
So basically what happened was Barclays was going to buy, it wasn't going to merge with Lehman Brothers because Lehman was already sort of heading down the drain of history at that point, but it was going to buy the remaining functioning parts of the company in what was called an asset purchase agreement. So they were going to buy the good stuff and let the rest of it go down the drain of the bankruptcy bureaucracy. And what they did is they struck deals with about a dozen Barclays executives, I'm sorry, a dozen Lehman executives before dawn on the day of the last Lehman board meeting and promised them upwards of $300 million in future compensation at Barclays. And what those executives actually did is they ended up mismarking Lehman's assets in Barclays' favor for the ultimate sale to Barclays. It was somewhere between $5 and $12 billion weighted too heavily in Barclays' favor. So as one lawyer described it to me, it was the biggest bank robbery in history. They essentially bribed a group of insiders to phony up the trade. And there was really no law that immediately applied or that anybody can think of. The only remedy that the victims, who were the creditors of Lehman Brothers, could think to even try to use was to try to reverse the bankruptcy decision, and they ended up losing that case too. So this went completely unpunished, and nobody even thought about investigating or prosecuting it.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who is the author of Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, just out from Spiegel and Grau. And then, of course, none of the others, Countrywide Savings, Mozilla. I mean, that was a criminal operation from start to finish. In contrast with what happened, 20 years earlier at the savings and loans, he and the bank got off scot-free.
Angelo Mozilla, right, I mean, he basically blew up the universe, this guy. He invented the whole mechanism that drove the subprime mortgage crisis, which was to go out and give loans to anybody. I mean, one of his senior executives had a personalized license plate that read Fundum on the back, which was basically a symbol of their whole policy, which was to give loans to anybody and everybody. They have emails from Mozilla where he said things like, I've never seen products that were more toxic ever, talking about his own home loans while he was selling them. And yet even though the SEC brought a case against him, the ultimate penalty that he had to pay, most of it was covered by a Bank of America insurance policy, and he ended up walking away with something like $450 million in income, which was basically ill-gotten gains. What's so interesting about that is that this is exactly the kind of person, if you were going to pick as a target of a symbolic prosecution for all the crimes of this age, he was the patient zero of the subprime mortgage crisis, and not only did he not get prosecuted, but he was allowed to keep most of his money. You contrast this with a single mom on welfare. If she gets $800 too much in welfare, her restitution is going to be $800. I mean, it's not like they're going to let her keep any money. And they let people like Mozilla keep all their money, and people from AIG keep all of their money, and from Merrill Lynch, and all these companies all the way down the line.
Now, to ask this question is to answer it, of course, but one of the reasons we arrest people and prosecute them is it's not just to punish individual malefactors, but to set an example and to show what is tolerated and what isn't tolerated, and to discourage others, right? And so what is the message if you're a CEO or a big-time banker, what is the message you get out of all this?
The message repeatedly is, go forth and commit crimes. And what's so interesting about that, your question, is that this is a community of people who would be extremely responsive to the deterrent of jail. They're not like career criminals who spend a lot of time in prison. If you start sending bankers to prison for subprime mortgage fraud, there's not going to be a whole lot of subprime mortgage fraud. Pretty quickly, that's going to end. But what they did instead was exactly the worst thing. They, instead of sending people to jail, instead of making people personally pay 100% restitution or more, they instead got companies to pick up the tab for fines. And all that really did was set the price of doing business for companies that planned on making money through a perhaps illegal business model. Because now if you're going to have to pay 10% in the worst case scenario to a regulatory fine, you actually have more cost certainty going forward. So not only is it not a deterrent, it's actually an encouragement to crime when you don't send people to jail and you just give them a fine. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, if you have to give up 10% of profits you shouldn't have had,
bad deal. You can live with that,
Where is this coming from? Is this like the oligarchy now so totally taken over the federal government and every other layer of government as well? Is it political cowardice?
It's like that line in Casablanca, you know, it's a combination of all three, you know, and it's everything. You know, I think we have reached the point, and I tried as much as I could to get to this in the book, but I think it's almost like this amorphous conclusion that we have now reached the stage in our history where we simply don't think of certain people as being the kind of people who go to jail. And I even heard that coming from people in law enforcement who said things to me like, well, what these people did, they weren't crimes, or, you know, they're not criminals, they just broke the law, you know, and this is a mentality where you start thinking of people who, you know, work at, you know, under the auspices of a big, too big to fail company as not being the sort of person you want to throw in jail. This is the kind of person who you're going to get to pay a fine. And once we psychologically reach that place, that's a very dangerous place for us to get to, because what's automatically going to happen is we're going to start to send everybody else to jail, and we're going to sort people into jailable and non-jailable classes. And that seems to me what is happening on a mass scale.
And the teenager who jumps a turnstile and is caught with a joint in his pocket, that is the kind of person who goes to jail.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. When they say that jail is not an appropriate resolution for somebody at, let's say, HSBC, what HSBC did, that really was crime. I mean, when you're laundering money for Mexican drug traffickers who murder lots of people, that's like the definition of crime, right? But because of the kind of people they were, they stretched that definition and they decided that that wasn't an appropriate resolution for those people. However, some broke kid who jumps the subway turnstile and he has, you know, a little bit of weed in his pocket, that person can spend a few nights in jail because that person is used to dirt and grime and the danger of a bad neighborhood. And so why not put that person in jail? It's a subtle thing, but that's what's going on in the minds of prosecutors right now. They're thinking that way, and they're applying that unconscious standard to everybody, and that's how we're ending up with this situation.
You were in Moscow in the final days of the Soviet Union and the early days of the Yeltsin rot. Would you muse on any similarities between the current United States and the then Soviet Union?
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, that was when I was in the Soviet Union, that was one of the first things I noticed, was that there were two sets of rules, that there were some people who got in trouble and other people who didn't get in trouble. And, you know, we had these kids who would try to sell us rabbit hats and military gear, and they wanted Western clothes in return. And every a couple of times a week, those kids would get arrested by the police and they would disappear for a couple of weeks or longer. And yet, on those same days, you'd see directors of the university walking right by the same cops wearing blue jeans and foreign suits and stuff like that, and they wouldn't get in trouble. And that was because that same kind of sorting process had been implanted, you know, internalized in the brains of Soviet citizens over decades. We just know that some people get in trouble and other people don't get in trouble. That's what we're going through here in the States. It's not as extreme as it was in the Soviet Union, or maybe it is, I don't know, but it's the same kind of thing, and I think that's what people have to worry about.
What about the extent of the official corruption and ossification? I mean, it also seems like, you know, the society at the top is beginning to look more and more like the rotting Soviet society at the top.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the parallels between the bailouts in 2008 and the illegal privatizations in the mid-90s in Russia, there are so many that, I mean, it would be impossible to count them all. But basically, when you have a commingling of powerful financial interests and state officials, you know, we talk here about the revolving door between Wall Street and the regulatory system, and it's the same thing over there. I mean, we're beginning to resemble in many ways a third world state, and what's more important is not the rule of law, but really who you are. And what kind of connections you have. I mean, the Russians have a concept that they call blat or poblaku, which is like, you know, if you know somebody, you can get out of a situation or you can get out of trouble. But if you don't have that option, then all of a sudden the law applies to you. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here is, you know, if you have enough money to slow that mindless punishment machine, then that's one thing. But if you don't, then all of a sudden you're subject to the law. That's more the characteristics of a third world state than the country we used to be.
finally, we also seem to have a very resigned and alienated population that is just sort of now takes this as normal.
Yeah, I think that's a critical element to the whole thing, which is once upon a time, and it's not just with the criminal justice system, it's with everything, right? I mean, would you imagine 20 years ago that if we had a program where thousands of people around the world were being extra-legally assassinated by American flying robots, that there would be no protests about that at all? I mean, I think it seems to me that when I was in college, if that was going on, we'd have an endless series of protests about that sort of thing. But I think we have corruption fatigue in America. You know, it began in the Bush administration, and now I think after the disappointment of Obama when we elected this constitutional lawyer who talked about ending all the abuses of the Bush years, and, you know, not only did he not do that, but he worsened them in some cases. We have this awesome illegal surveillance program that is being conducted by the NSA, and that depresses us and discourages us. And this thing with crime, every single time they don't prosecute one of these big financial companies that's guilty of a serious crime, and they do prosecute somebody else who has committed a minor crime, it has the effect of generally discouraging the whole population. And I think that's where we're at right now. We had a little protest during Occupy. It didn't move the needle all that much, and that makes us even more resigned than before.
See, is there some note of non-resignation you could summon to?
It's so funny how every one of my interviews ends with, there's no hope and you should just go home and open your veins. And no, I do think with the issues that I cover that there's some awareness about it. I think there are some people in Washington who want to fix some of this stuff. We do see, like this week, Eric Holder deciding to criminally charge Credit Suisse, that they're listening a little bit. But still, in that case, nobody's going to be indicted. Nobody's going to go to jail. No individual anyway. But I just think that progress, if there is any, is going to be slow and steady. But there's a little bit of hope, I would say.